University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Ursula Walsh, Director of Research and Sports Science for the National Collegiate Athletic Association, speaking on the NCAA, Voice of College Sports. Walsh was on staff at the University of Nebraska for over 10 years, ending in 1985. While there, she served in various positions, including academic consultant to the athletic department, assistant professor of computer science, and adjunct professor of educational psychology. She consulted with the Big Eight Athletic Conference in surveys determining graduation rates and a substance abuse study. Other consulting work has involved the Nebraska Department of Labor and the New York Jets professional football team. She received her bachelor's degree from Rosary College in River Forest, Illinois, and completed graduate study at the College of St. Thomas in Minnesota and the University of Minnesota before receiving her Ph.D. in measurement and statistics from the University of Nebraska.
When I first met Ursula Walsh, but I do remember exactly where I met her. It was in a kind of a sleepy late afternoon seminar room down at the University of Nebraska, probably about 1970, would you suppose? We were sleepy late afternoon graduate students together there. She was principal at Cathedral High School in Omaha at the time. I was, as I still am, a noontime basketball player. And if you'd asked me which of us was to go on to fame in athletics, I wouldn't have guessed Ursula. But there is some justice in the world after all, I guess. Through a combination of happenstance and ability and hard work, she went on to become the academic consultant to the University of Nebraska Athletic Department, where she established a national reputation as one of the people working hardest to keep academic integrity and perspective in college athletics. It made big network sports news one year when Ursula Walsh reportedly advised a star football player to attend the University of Oklahoma because they had a special academic program that interested him. Now, the sports announcers were amazed, but if they'd known Ursula better, they wouldn't have been surprised at all. It's the way she does business. Ursula served as academic consultant at Nebraska from 1972 until 1985, when she became director of research and sports science for the National Collegiate Athletic Association. But I don't want you to think that she's just another great athlete. She did her undergraduate work in mathematics at Rosary College, master's degrees in counseling psychology, and in physics and mathematics at St. Thomas and the University of Minnesota, and a Ph.D. in measurement and statistics at the University of Nebraska. In addition, during her 13 years at Nebraska, she taught educational psychology and computer science. You'll be pleased to know that she's become a special fan of NCAA Division III schools like Wesleyan. You'll also be pleased to know that Ursula tells me we joined the NCAA in 1961, and during that time, we've never been investigated. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ursula Walsh, whose topic today is the NCAA, Voice of College Sports.
And we might add that Nebraska Wesleyan University is unique in this city in being uninvestigated. Ken told me this morning that he told Chuck Reed, your sports information director, that you had been an uninvestigated member of the NCAA since 1961. And Mr. Reed said, "What did we do in 1961? So perhaps my visit here will trigger an investigation of some kind. I think that's what most people think when the NCAA comes to your campus. Now, you are the products of liberal education, and I want you to reflect for just a moment about what you think when you meet someone from the NCAA. Now, if I asked you, a friend of yours came to you and said, "I've just been hired by the NCAA," what would you think about that? So we're going to do a little test here now, and I want you to pay close attention. In my right hand, I have a quarter. And I'm going to step back, and I'm going to transfer this quarter from my right hand to my left, and I want you to watch that. Now, I'd like all of you who think I really did that to raise your right hand. If you think the quarter is now in my left hand, put your hands up. You think it's in the left hand. Now, how many of you think I did not do that? Quarter is still over here. Come on, get the hands up. I want you to see that I did that. Now, I'm going to do that once more. I'm going to transfer it to the left hand. Now, show me again how many think I really did that. How many think it's still in the right hand? Well, you people that raised your hand and believed that I did really do it. You are trusting, you are honest, you are sensitive, and you who think I did not, after two times, you are hostile, suspicious, paranoid, and you have been influenced by the press about the NCAA. They tell a joke about the two greatest lies in the world. The first is that the check is in the mail, and the second is, I am from the NCAA, and I'm here to help. I will hope now that you will, by that demonstration, you will be able to clear all those cobwebs of prejudice from your minds, and that you will be able to listen to this presentation in a very open-minded way. And that after this, you will always know that the NCAA is here to serve and protect. See, listen to that. It's not right, is it? We're here to serve and protect. First, I'd like to look with you at the membership structure of the NCAA and then the governing structure of the NCAA, how it works, a little bit about the central office where I work. We'll look at the history of the NCAA, that is, how it came into being back in 1906, and then some current and rather controversial topics that the NCAA is now pursuing. One of those will be the academic regulations that apply to Divisions 1 and 2, and secondly, the NCAA drug testing program, to which, of course, all divisions are subject. I have a tape of the drug testing procedures, which I hope we'll get to at the end of the presentation, and then if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. There are in the NCAA really five divisions of institutions. There are divisions 1, 2, and 3, but within Division 1, we have divisions 1A, 1AA, and 1AAA, and I'll talk about each of those at not very great extent. Division 1, of course, you are familiar with. There are certain requirements for each of these divisions, and you may know all those things. Division 1 has to sponsor a certain number of men's sports, 6 men's sports, 6 women's sports, 2 team sports within each of those. They also have to schedule a certain number of their contests against other Division 1 institutions. If you are in Division 1A, that is a football conference, Division 1A institutions have to sponsor 7 sports, including football. They have to have a minimum attendance of 17,000. At each home game, they have to have a stadium that holds at least 30,000 permanent seats. So these are big institutions, and you know them. You have one here in your own city. The University of Nebraska-Lincoln is an outstanding Division 1A institution. Division 1AA is right below that. The Ivy schools are Division 1AA. They do not have to have the same kind of attendance requirements. They do not have the same stadium size. They have their own playoff championships. You see Division 1A, 1AA football, and Division 1 AAA. Division 1 AAA does not have Division 1 football. Those are generally big basketball institutions. Creighton University is 1AAA, Georgetown, Marquette, St. John's. Those kinds of schools would be 1AAA. Altogether, there are 242 Division 1 active members, that is, different institutions that participate and compete in Division I. Conferences that are composed of Division I institutions also belong to that division and may vote in Division I. So there are 342 Division I members altogether. Division II offers fewer sports, 4 varsity intercollegiate sports for men, 4 for women, 2 of which again have to be team sports. In football, they must sponsor at least 50% of their games against Divisions 1 and 2, and in basketball, the same thing. members of Division II with which you might be familiar would be University of Nebraska, Omaha, Southern Illinois, Edwardsville, those kinds of institutions. There are 205 Division II institutions with the conference members. Division III, in which I assume you are most interested, is unique among the divisions. Some Division III graduates and graduates of Division III institutions are somewhat arrogant about Division III and its purity in comparison with Divisions I and II. I have an assistant who insists that no athlete is educated unless he is at a Division III institution. That doesn't always go over really well with other people, but he is a living testimonial to that. In Division III, all aid is need-based. That is, there are no athletics grants and aids, as you know. Financial aid may not be offered until the student is admitted, and then only by the director of financial aid. And in fact, at the most recent convention down in Nashville this month, Division III passed some more restrictive legislation, insisting that no member of the Department of Athletics may have anything to do with the financial aid office. In Division III, if academic honor awards are offered to the student athlete, these awards are offered independent of any kind of consideration for athletics ability. Work study is administered as it is for all other students. Financial aid package offered to the student athlete is consistent with the financial aid package offered to all other students. So the philosophy is that the student athlete, in his financial aid, in his admission, and in all respects of his academic life, is indistinguishable from the student population at large. This is unique to the NCAA membership. Division III offers four sports for men, two team sports, four sports for women, two team sports. There's no letter of intent for football, and Division III schedules and plays more than 50% of its football contests versus Division III. There are waivers possible in all these divisions, and in fact, Nebraska Wesleyan University has been recipient of a waiver since 1982, so that this scheduling requirement is not in place for Nebraska Wesleyan University, and that is because of geographic isolation from other Division III institutions. This is the only Division III institution in the state of Nebraska. There are, I believe, 12 or 13 in Iowa and 10 or more in Minnesota, but those institutions also have conference affiliations, and perhaps because Wesleyan is a power in basketball, they might be reluctant to schedule. And I mean that sincerely. They may be reluctant to schedule. One does not happily schedule defeats against non-conference institutions, generally. And I don't mean that in a facetious way. In Division III, Division III is the largest of the five. There are 321 Division III active member institutions, most of them in the East, 353 with the conference affiliations. Besides the member institutions and the conferences, there are other members of the NCAA. There are two classes called affiliated and corresponding members. Affiliated members would be like the American Football Coaches Association. They get the news. They have no vote, but they can come to the convention as a non-voting member. Corresponding members are community colleges and some junior colleges. Meadowlands Sports Complex is a corresponding member. They, again, get the NCAA news, the newspaper. They can't use the name or the logo. They can't vote. They can't come to the convention, but they keep informed about the concerns of the association. Altogether, there are over 1,000 members in the NCAA. It's a little understood fact that the NCAA is a pure democracy. It is a democracy just as surely as the New England town meetings were. All of the legislation, all of the rules that are passed at the convention, and all of them are voted on by the members. So that you will read in the paper occasionally, NCA has done this, and it is ridiculous. Well, those are things that the members voted into the legislation. There is a convention every January, and all the members assemble, and they vote on the legislation. They indeed suggest the legislation. So any six members may suggest a piece of legislation. There's a little form that they fill out. Suppose that you would like to change the Division III stand on financial aid. You think it's only reasonable that athletic ability should be considered. After all, if musicians are recruited for Nebraska Wesleyan University, they are seen as valuable to the orchestra, then they could be given aid on the basis of their musical ability. And you think that it's only logical that this also be true for athletes. And so you decide that legislation could be introduced. You will go to one of four people on your campus. You have your president, who is John White, and you have a faculty representative, Art Nicolai, who is here, I believe, and your athletic director, director of athletics, Jerry Schmuddy, who is next to him, and you have a primary woman administrator, Nancy Hansen. I don't know where she is. So you will go to one of these four people, depending on your relationship with them, and you will give them an impassioned speech about the fact that athletes should have some financial aid on their ability. They add a great deal to your campus. They add something to the status of the university, the prestige, and you feel it's only right. You convince them, let's say, and then they must find five other sponsors for this bill. They fill out a form from the NCAA before November 1 of the year that you want it introduced, and it goes into this book. And everybody studies it, and it says right there that this will be voted on by Division III only. When we get to the convention, Division III meets in a business session, and people stand up and speak for and against your bill. And if it's passed, it becomes effective generally the next August, but maybe right away. Some things are effective immediately. And then, of course, everyone in Division III lives with that legislation. And there will be some disaffected persons, one assumes, some that will not be happy with it, some that will be happy with it, some that may want to amend it the following year. But it is from the membership that these kinds of rules are made. When it has been passed in May or June of that year, it gets incorporated in here as an amendment. These are all the rules, and you look up Division III financial aid, and you'll see amended 1988. Your name won't be on there, but you will know that that is your piece of legislation. Now, if we can pause just a moment, a year ago, the members the numbers of basketball players in Division I was reduced from 15, they can have 15 full grants in basketball in Division I, to 13. This was voted on at the convention. A real firestorm followed this legislation. And if you read the Lincoln Star, you read that Bobby Knight stood up and said that he was going to leave the NCAA because this was an absolutely asinine decision. Well, Bobby Knight should be speaking to the president of Indiana University because Division I institutions passed that legislation. It was, I might add, rescinded in June of 1987, so it was a short-lived piece of legislation. Those who don't know how the governance system works have an image of this group of benighted people in Mission, Kansas, who make these rules with no contact with the persons who are out there on the firing line. And this simply is not the case. The staff at the national office is there to protect and serve and to implement the legislation after it is made by the member institutions. Remember again that the affected institutions are the ones who vote on this legislation. So Division I does not vote on things which have to do only with Division III. Division III institutions are the ones who do that. Member institutions make the laws then, and while they are not always happy with them, they do, for the most part, live within them. Beyond the legislation, there are interpretations of the laws which are made every day. These are made some at the national office and some through a continuing body that is set up to take care of things between conventions. So we have a council that is elected by the convention. The council is formed of Divisions 1, 2, and 3. Also, there's a secretary and a treasurer and Divisions 1, 2, and 3 vice presidents. Council then acts on things between conventions, and all of its actions have to be affirmed by the convention in the following year. There's an executive committee, too, composed of the officers, Divisions 1, 2, and 3 vice presidents, the president, and secretary treasurer, and the executive director, and nine different members elected at large. And these persons take care of the budget. The budget of the NCA is now $79 million. This year it is $79 million. And that handles all the championships, publications, all our salaries, of course, the committee meetings, and I'll speak more about that. The NCAA gives out 100 postgraduate scholarships a year. Each of those is worth $4,000 a year. And then there are some grants that go to conference institutions. These grants are new. They will amount to about $120,000 a year, and they are for the purpose of improving officiating, minority opportunities, compliance and enforcement issues, and drug education. So conferences will be applying for those grants, and they will be going out this year. The revenue, as you probably know, comes mostly from the Division I basketball tournament, and of course, each of the member institutions pays a membership fee to the NCAA. There are a good number of committees that run things for the NCAA. These committees are composed of persons from the member institutions, and each of the sports and each of the divisions has a committee. There's a Division III women's basketball committee, a Division III men's basketball committee. These persons have a great deal to do with running the tournaments as much as anything else. There are also committees that I work with, the research committee, academic requirements committee, foreign student records committee, special subcommittee on academic standards, committee on competitive safeguards and medical aspects of sports. Those kinds of things I am liaison to. Generally, these committees meet a couple of times a year. We look at issues that are before us. They make recommendations to the council and sometimes recommend legislation. They are, again, all representatives of member institutions. The central office where I work is in Mission, Kansas. It is probably, if you're familiar with Overland Park, it's just north of Overland Park, Kansas, and near Kansas City, Kansas and Missouri. We do a lot of things every day. For example, the research that is ongoing at the national office is something that I work with. We collect injury data, for example, on 13 sports. Whenever those sports are in season, we collect injury data on football, men's and women's soccer, men's and women's lacrosse, baseball, softball, field hockey, ice hockey, men's and women's gymnastic, wrestling, and women's volleyball at this time. Data are collected from a representative sample of the member institutions, and we report those data to the sports committees, to the rules committees, and to any interested individuals that may call and ask for those data. Last spring, 1987, Nebraska Wesleyan University collected data on both baseball and softball injuries, and these are reported to Nebraska Wesleyan with their own data first, what injuries they had in a summary form, and then on regional, what injuries there were in this region, national level, and also a district level. So it is of some benefit to the institution, and it is of immense benefit to the association. I just prepared a paper on injuries on natural versus artificial turf for Division I institutions, and surprisingly enough, in fact, my assistant, who's a very capable person, told me that it was counterintuitive. We had more injuries on natural surfaces than on artificial surfaces. And in fact, in serious knee injuries, the ratio was 4-1. There were 12 serious knee injuries on natural turf and 3 on artificial turf. It was simply descriptive data and wasn't anything else, and we don't claim anything else, but I'm sure that when it is published, and it will be published this week, you will hear about it. We have a lot of speculation about why this happened, and one of the hypotheses is that the turf is in very good shape on those institutions. But we'll see. We're going to certainly follow it up for another year. The NCAA National Office is composed of 7 different departments. The departments are administration, of which I am a part, and then business, which just takes care of the accounting, championships, with which you are familiar, and all the championships, meet with all those committees, take care of disseminating the rules, you know, those rules books on different championships, keep track of all the records, which are all on our computer, all those kinds of things. Compliance and enforcement, with which you are probably familiar, and I think many people out in the in our reading public think that compliance and enforcement is what we do full time. You see these agents slinking about, ready to pounce on the unwary and probably innocent people out there. Compliance and enforcement does not just do that. Compliance, in fact, has a mandate which is quite different from enforcement, and that is to see that that you know what the rules are, and if there's any help that can be given, it is given. They prepare an audit that can be done every year, and a kind of a, like when the North Central comes in and you do a self-study, they have a self-study that you can go through and to be sure that you are in compliance with the rules and that you are running a program that has integrity and of which your university can be proud. We have also legislative services. Legislative services is a cadre of mostly lawyers. You call legislative services if you'd like an interpretation of the rule. There have been a good many reasonable complaints about the rule book. The rules have mushroomed, and they continue to mushroom every year, and this is being revised. It will be put in better order, and it will now be about three times as large. But it means that when you look for the rules for Division A, you don't have to look all through the book. Everything that will be repeated that relates to Division III, and one hopes that it will be simplified, at least. That is the idea. We have a national computer network into which you can dial if you belong to the network, and you can see all the interpretations. Put in a keyword like Division III financial aid, and all the interpretations that have been made since 1972 or sometime will be shown, and so we hope that that will be some help, too. They're quite readable and fairly well organized. Enforcement certainly has to do with the infractions. There are reports of infractions. People call in anonymously and otherwise. They write in and they say, this is going on at Nebraska Wesleyan University and we'd like it looked into. And a nice young enforcement rep comes out and meets with Mr. Schmutty, and they talk about the problems that they see, and then Nebraska Wesleyan, if they think there's anything to it, will begin their own investigation of that matter, and they will meet then with the infraction committee, which is, again, composed of member institutions, and the infraction committee will hear both sides and will decide on the penalty, if there is to be one. Publications is another department of the NCAA that published the NCAA News and all these things that you see, all the championships handbooks, all the rules books. We have a library at the NCAA in which scholars come to work, which is the archives. There are championships back there into the early days of the 1900s, and people will call and say that they'd like to hear about who was the champion of the golf tournament in 1910, and we look that up for them and let them know. We had a letter the other day from a man who was upset about something that the NCAA had done, and he wanted his name expunged from the championships. So I wrote back to him and I said I was unable to find his name, but if I did, I wouldn't have been able to expunge it anyway, I suppose. Those people then, 160 of them at the national office, are working hard to see that the membership is served and that we can respond to their needs as quickly and as clearly as possible. Legislative services, to which I referred earlier, the lawyers who answer your questions about the staff, have been referred to by our new executive director as the whipping boy of the NCAA, and I think to a large extent they are. They are the ones who have to say, this is a violation, no, you cannot do that, and probably of 40 calls that they get during a day, each representative, they say no most of the time. It is their interpretations that make the headlines, and you remember these types of interpretations. Last year, Steve Alford, who was a great basketball at Indiana University, great basketball player at Indiana University, was forced to sit out a game because he allowed his picture to be taken for a calendar put out by a sorority to raise money for charity. And later in that year, a basketball coach was not permitted to watch his son play in a high school tournament because that would be against the recruiting restrictions. These kinds of decisions make life difficult for the people in legislative services, but they are not empowered to make exceptions. If the rule says this is the law, then those persons have to say that. And it makes the NCAA look very bad when persons who were not supposed to be affected by this legislation are affected by it. The new executive director is working diligently in an attempt to supply more flexibility. And in fact, there is a law that was passed in the convention in January, just a couple weeks ago, proposal number 45, which does allow the council to make exceptions to bylaw 51J, which is the academic requirements for divisions 1 and 2. We will see how that works. I'm going to be working directly with that, and I am somewhat apprehensive about it. Now, the history of the NCAA. We look at what is the purpose and what is the aim of the NCAA. What are its basic concerns? Originally, in 1906, the NCAA was founded to save the sport of football. Even today, we consider football a brutal and violent sport, but it has nothing on the old days. For example, in 1883, the Harvard Committee on Athletics said that it was a game no longer governed by a manly spirit of fair play, but instead pervaded by a spirit of sharpers and rogues. At the end of 1884, Harvard dropped the sport and in its parting salvo called football brutal, demoralizing to teams and players, and extremely dangerous. I want to read just a brief excerpt from, this is Jack Fallis' history of the NCAA, and he talks about a certain play that I think even now we will find almost unbelievable. Okay, this is back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. It is about this time that another sports-related problem began to show itself, a problem that in the long run will prove even more troublesome than football violence. Hired athletes or tramp football players began showing up on college rosters. The specter of the twin issues, recruitment and eligibility, begins to cast what will be an ever-darkening shadow. But the game thrives, increasing in popularity and violence. Another new tactic, the hurdle play, is introduced. While it doesn't prove as popular as the flying wedge, it will serve to show what we might consider the high watermark of dangerous play. Listen to this now. This is almost... In the hurdle play, a small back is given the ball. The back takes a running leap onto the arms of his teammates and up the back of the center and literally is flung feet first over the defensive line, hurtling through the air at a height of 5 or 6 feet. Well, we haven't heard anything yet. The ultimate defense of the hurdle play is invented by Princeton in 1902 and is worth our attention if we are to appreciate fully the state of the game in this era. You can imagine the ultimate defense. Yeah. When Columbia throws little halfback Harold Weeks across the line in a hurdle play, the Princeton defense counters by hurling one of its own players, Dana Kafer, into the air to intercept Weeks. The ensuing mid-air collision puts Weeks and Kafer out of the game, probably to their mutual relief, and undoubtedly to their mortal well-being. So you see how it was. And in 1906, a group of universities, mostly on the East Coast, got together and began an association to legislate for football. The public, you see, was addicted to football, and to sort of save the game, this association and the NCAA, as it would later be called, was formed to bring some sanity into that game. And it's come, of course, a long way since that time. The growth of the NCAA was slow. The individual member institutions were wary about reducing their autonomy over the sports they sponsored. And even today, we are often reminded of this jealously guarded commodity. One of the cornerstones of the NCAA is the principle of institutional control. That is, the legislation passed by the members would respect the individual institutions. Another of the cornerstones is the principle of sound academic standards. And to look at sound academic standards, we really look at a triad of sometimes conflicting concerns. They are, first, the desire for competitive equity among institutions, second, financial considerations, and third, the pressure to preserve academic integrity at institutions of higher education. And at one time or another, each of these threes come into ascendancy. And when one becomes ascendant, then the others feel threatened and there's a push for another. And you see this in the history of academic legislation in the NCAA over the years. Division III, as I mentioned, because of its philosophy in student-athletes being an integral part of the student body, student-athletes not being treated differently from the rest of the student body, is, as we said, different from Divisions I and II, who have had more problems in this area. In 1966, the first legislation was passed about academic requirements for eligibility, and this was the famous 1.6 rule. The 1.6 rule declared that a student athlete to compete must be able to predict a 1.6 grade point average at the collegiate institution. So on the basis of high school grades and a score on a standardized test, SAT or ACT, they used a regression equation and they looked to see if a 1.6 would be predicted. And if so, this student athlete had initial eligibility. That is, he could begin to play as a freshman. In 1966, however, there was legislation against competing as a freshman on a varsity team if you were playing football and basketball. And this is another concern that has surfaced again this year, whether or not freshmen should compete. And here we see the academic integrity issue preponderant. Academic integrity was used as a rationale for not having student-athletes compete as freshmen. It was proposed that these student-athletes needed time to become adjusted to the institution, to the difference between that and high school, and that they could not at the same time be burdened with a competitive a sports schedule. And I see some of you that do believe that. And if the rest of you students remember your freshman year, you do remember that it was not a time of great tranquility, shall we say. It is a time of transition and in some cases trauma. So there's a strong argument made for not having freshmen. But then we come to the financial issue, and institutions say, well, you know, so that's great for the big schools, and they can certainly field teams and not have to worry about the freshmen. But if I'm going to have that much money involved in the freshmen, they're going to have to play. So financial issues came there, and also competitive equity. Big institutions looked at recruiting, and they said to themselves, look, if I make people sit out during the freshman year, I'm not going to have as good a chance to get some of these good players because they want to compete. So I better have a freshman schedule, and that added more money. And so you see the circularity of this problem. In 1972, the 1.6 rule was rescinded, and a new rule was introduced that said, look, if you've got a 2.0 out of high school overall, you're eligible. This went along for a long time, in fact, until 1983, when Proposition 48 was introduced at the convention to become effective in 1986, and it is Proposition 48, now known as Bylaw 5-1J, which is in place, has been in place for a year. Bylaw 5-1J says that Divisions 1 and 2, initial eligibility, you must have 11 core courses from high school, 3 in English, 2 in math, 2 in social sciences, 2 in natural sciences, and 2 additional. You must have at least a 2.0 in that core curriculum, and you must score at least the 700 composite on the SAT and a 15 on the ACT. Not terribly restrictive scores, but there was a great deal of controversy about Proposition 48 when it was passed in 19, uh, 83, especially from the tradition of black institutions, who felt seriously discriminated against by these test scores. And I think if we know anything about the history of mental testing, we do know that socioeconomic status and test scores are positively correlated. And if you have a group of people who have been systematically discriminated against for hundreds of years, then certainly they're not going to score so well. And we see it. And the people who are excluded on Prop 48 bases right now, good many of them are black students. And so the controversy still rages over that. And we are doing a 10-year study on the effects of Bylaw 51J, looking at these things to see if the population parameters change over the years, to see if these variables are predictive. But still, there is a good deal of uneasiness about the proposal, especially the test score. And it may be that with proposal number 45 that passed at the convention, we will be able to look at the caliber of a student's high school preparation, and perhaps we can waive the test requirement in those cases. And that may introduce a new element of justice, and one hopes. I am going to quickly close here with just the drug testing a tape which I want you to watch. The NCAA has never been free of controversy, and I'm sure that you know that. One of the more recent controversies has involved the drug testing program. Membership considered legislation for drug testing in 1985 and rejected it. In 1986, it was passed, and now drug testing is performed at the championships across the board, men and women, all divisions. The crews come in and test for drugs. There are a great many drugs to be tested for. We test for street drugs and for anabolic steroids, psychomotor stimulants, central nervous stimulants, diuretics, all kinds of drugs that could be either performance enhancing or that could affect the individual's physical well-being. So the purposes of the drug testing are first to establish competitive equity. It is perfectly dreadful to think that young women might feel they must take anabolic steroids in order to be competitive in field events, let us say. It's perfectly a dreadful idea. And to prevent that, to prevent you from having to compete with other persons who are doing this, we do test. One hopes that in time you will feel discriminated against if you are not tested, that you will feel that it is there to protect you from others who might be taking advantage of things that would give them a competitive advantage. So you will see here the procedure of the drug testing, and I show this to you because one of the controversies is that it's not certain and that you might have a positive and that you would then be marked, stigmatized, and you would be completely innocent. That is not the case. Each of these tests, just the analysis of this test, cost $250. It is done with the latest state-of-the-art. The urine is tested three times. It is a very expensive and, I believe, a foolproof process. One hopes that it is done for you as athletes and not to in any way discriminate against you. Ken?
Today, University Forum has presented Ursula Walsh, Director of Research and Sports Science for the National Collegiate Athletic Association. She spoke on the NCAA, Voice of College Sports. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.